Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Ammo Art Chat. My name is Linda Fissler. And today we'll be talking to Michael Pierce, who is the chair of the art department at Cal Lutheran University in California. And we are also, I guess you could say, we have a full house. We have my two co-hosts with me, Blanche McAllister-Harris and Barbara Coleman as well. And I know this is a strange time for some of our listeners to call in or to dial us in and listen to us. We did a 1:30 call today, so on the East Coast, and part of that is because Michael's got a very busy schedule, and he also has a family, and I'm sure he wants to spend his evenings with the family, so we decided to go with an earlier show. So thank you all who are tuning in and listening to us. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do that. And I wanted to, what we'll actually be talking about today on the show is the Representational Art Conference. It's called Track 2012, as you may have heard it referred to as that way as well. And that's one of the reasons why we asked Michael to come on the show, because he's the chair there at the university that's holding the conference. And he will be talking to us about that conference, as well as his show that he just opened on September 8th at the Carnegie Museum. And we'll also talk a little bit about the representational art renaissance that is going on and getting his views on that. And just wanted to also mention that we're going to go back to our schedule of once a month shows after this. My co-hosts have been so gracious to put up with me all through the summer with the number of shows that we had with the weekend with the Masters and everything. And I really appreciate them doing that. We were doing about three, or actually this is our fourth show in September, but we did three shows or so a month leading up to the weekend with the Masters. And They've been great hanging in with me to do that, but we need to paint, and we need to do a few other things as well, and that's why we're going to drop back to once a month. And our shows are actually going to be really, the one that's coming up in October, we're going to call Keeping It Fresh, Inspiration Through Exploration and Learning. And I'm not going to announce who the folks are yet, because I don't have them 100% confirmed, but keep an eye out for our newsletter, because we'll announce it in there for sure within the next couple days. So with that, I would like to bring in Blanche and Barbara. Hello, Blanche. How are you?
Hey, Linda. I'm doing well. Good. I haven't painted much recently. I'm sort of redoing a few things in my studio, cleaning it out and rearranging things, but I hope to get right back to the painting. How about
you?
Yeah,
I've been doing well. Went out for a bike ride this morning. Actually had lunch with Joanna Arnett and Jim Asher, who are on their way to Vermont. And Joanna ended up in my studio giving me critiques. So now I have a stack of art that
great?
I have to go, you know, changes that I have to make to some of my paintings. But it's always great visiting with them. And we hadn't seen them for, I guess, since April. So it was really good to talk with them and visit with them. So, I know the feeling about wanting to get back into the studio. I definitely do, too. So.
Yeah.
And then we also have with us Barbara McReynolds-Coleman. I think that was your maiden name, right, Barbara?
That's right. Very good.
Yeah. So how have you been doing?
And I'm doing well. I'm enjoying this fall weather here in New Mexico. It's starting to cool off, and aspens are starting to turn, and I've been painting quite a bit, still focusing on that masterpiece miniature show up at Evergreen Fine Art that's coming up. So I've been out in the field and in the studio quite a bit.
Oh, good. It's finally fall here, too, so I'm glad the humidity is gone. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and I hear a yes from North Carolina, too.
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful yesterday. It was like in the low 70s, which is unusual this time of year for us.
We'll all be envious of Michael here in a few minutes, because, like I said, Michael's in California. But originally, he was born in Lincolnshire, Britton and is a figurative and installation artist. And Michael grew up in London in Wiltshire, where his father introduced him to impressive megalithic structures like Stonehenge, and they had a profound effect on Michael, whose adult work repeatedly refers to ancient history, mythology, and folklore. While his body of work connects him to his lifelong delight in stone circles and long barrows, it also refers to his study of natural philosophy. His works are marked by the use of symbolism, male and female imagery, and celestial references to address the mystical relationship between man and God. In 2008, Michael became solely interested in oil painting and created a series of new figurative works, the first group of new canvases being exhibited in August of 2011 called The New Romantic Figure. Michael's paintings, The Star and the Queen of Cups, Lady in Red, were presented in dramatic tabernacle frames that reference those found on pre-Raphaelite works, and Michael has researched the wet while painting methods of the pre-Raphaelite painters. So we'll talk to Michael about his latest show, which I mentioned earlier. It's in the Carnegie Museum, and that opened on September 8th. And although he uses Victorian and Renaissance studio techniques, he is determinedly contemporary, saying, quote, "We can't be painting for the 19th century. We have to paint for the 21st century," unquote. And I think that leads us probably into our representational Renaissance conversation that we'll have later on in the show. And Michael now lives in California, where he is the art department chair for California Lutheran University, teaching figurative paintings. In 2010, he introduced the atelier system to CLU's art department, in which each faculty member is provided with their own studio space on campus, and welcoming their students to learn alongside them. This marked the reintroduction of traditional studio training in the academic setting. We'll talk to Michael about this as well as the Representational Art Conference that's coming up October 14th through October 17th. And Michael, I guess at this point I'd like to say welcome to the show.
Well, hello there. It's so nice to be on the show with you guys.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking with you. I know we've had a couple conversations off air getting ready for the show, and I think it's going to be a really interesting show for folks, and a lot of great topics that we're going to talk about. And with that, I'm going to throw it over to Blanche to ask the first question.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Hey, Michael. First of all, I wanted to ask you, over the summer, we've been talking about the fact that representational art is not receiving the attention and accreditation that it should be receiving. Can you give us a definition of representational art so that we can all be thinking on the same page, and then talk with us about why you think that it is underrepresented?
Yes, absolutely. Representational art, of course, is art that looks like the real world. It's art that is recognizably human, or recognizably a landscape or a still life. It reshapes and reforms what's actually out there. It doesn't deconstruct it and break it all down into pieces and try to make something new of it. It tries to illuminate and reshape what's in the natural world. Hopefully that clarifies what that is. We had some trouble actually figuring out what the title of the conference would be, because we kept finding ourselves excluding people. We thought about calling it the Realist Art Conference, for example, but that excludes people who have a more fantastic leaning in their work and so on. We cast around for the right word for the conference, and representational art really captures everybody's work.
I see. And why do you think it has not been receiving the attention that it should be?
Wow. Well, I could go into this for an hour or two.
That's a big question.
Well,
yeah.
That's how long it has, Michael, so go for it.
Yeah. That all starts off with deconstruction, doesn't it? After World War II, so many artists and thinkers were kind of dismayed with the outcome of modernity and what it led to. If you have a world in which everything is rationalized and encyclopedized and defined, then you have a world in which massacring millions of people becomes possible, because they lack any spiritual shape or form. They don't matter. Do you see what I mean? Artists became dismayed by what modernity had led us to, and deconstructed everything, and wanted to break down painting and get away from the neoclassical tradition that had risen up, and break everything. And so consequently, you can track this whole gradual deformation and destruction of all things, beginning with those Dadaists in Zurich, and getting into Picasso and Braque and those folks, getting into Cubism, where they're breaking down the idea that a painting has to represent reality, and instead they're smashing it up into pieces and trying to show people and things from all different sides, and like mirror images of reality. And then you get into the 1970s and 80s, where art becomes so deteriorated that you have slashed canvases as a finished piece of work, and then nothingness as art. At the Tate Modern in London, the Turner Prize there recently was awarded to an artist who had a light bulb that was turned on and off. So the art now has become nothing. Even darkness is considered art in that postmodern deterioration and deconstruction. In that gradual process of deconstruction, representational art became anathema and was disregarded and ignored and considered dead. You know, we heard it in the 1970s and 80s that the painting was declared dead. There was no interest in painting. Recently at the conference here in Los Angeles, there was absolutely not a single paper that had anything to do with representational art of any kind, except for the art historians who actually did do some study of pre-19th century work. But nothing on any artist alive in the 20th century who had done any representational art at all. And I thought that was shocking. And wrote about it in about 2000, I think. But, you know, for many of us, we felt so isolated in the 80s and 90s. I've heard many times the same story, that people went to art schools in the 80s and 70s even, looking for training as a painter and wanted to become a painter. I myself went to school and deeply admired Caravaggio and wanted to paint like Caravaggio, and instead I was shown piles of shoes and bits of string around lampposts and told that that was art, and just didn't make any sense to me at all. I found that very hard, and did fall into it in a sort of half-hearted way, because I realized that was how to get a degree and all that. So that was very discouraging for people, and that neglect is really what's led us to this point now and why we're doing the conference, because so many artists have continued to make really great art in this last 100 years. There's a plethora of people who've been painting beautifully and doing wonderful work, and they haven't had any attention from the Academy, and that's not right. So we're doing the conference to readdress that in part, and get the idea that, you know, even though most of the Academy has decided that representational art didn't matter for 100 years, it does matter. It does matter. People are making this. It deserves academic attention and should have academic attention, and that's why we're doing it.
Well, I know I've talked to lots of artists who are frustrated with what they've learned when they're in college or at universities getting degrees, not learning things that help them with representational art. So it's frustrating for them to get the information and training that they need.
Well, yes. I mean, piles of shoes and pieces of string around lampposts, right? You know, this isn't a training. It's a training in maybe having ideas, and I respect that that's necessary. The creative process is challenging. To learn how to be creative, you have to learn how to think sideways. And some of these schools are rather good at that. You know, I went to one myself when I did my undergraduate degree at Dartington College in England. Actually, it was a theatre degree. The thing that they did extremely well was to stimulate our imaginations and help us to think sideways and in a creative way. That was amazing. working there and studying there. Just extraordinary. These amazing images. You'd be walking up the driveway and see people running around painted blue one day, you know, and then the next day you'd see people walking along with balloons dressed in Victorian clothing. And it was a wonderful place to study because of that. But it didn't teach us much in the way of training, you know, the technical work that that went into making great art. And I think that's unfortunate. We need to find more balance.
Yeah, that is a shame. That is.
Michael, are you familiar with Ken Wilber's writings, the philosopher?
I'm not. No, I don't.
He's written a number of amazing books, but he talks a lot about postmodernism, and he's coined a term for it called flatland, where all is devoid of meaning, and you know, truth, beauty, and the good, which for thousands of years is what you know human beings were striving for in philosophy and art, etc. You know, that's just been banished basically from any kind of artistic aspiration. And so his term for lack of meaning is flatland, and he talks quite a bit about how that translates into art, where you then do not see the value in representational art because, you know, there's no meaning even in the natural world, so why try to pursue or create beauty? And I think that has become so prevalent in our culture that I just applaud you enormously for doing this representational art conference and starting it in the academic sphere is where, you know, it needs to come back into play. Which leads me to the question of how do you think that the representational art conference will help?
Well, we're daring to say the word beauty in
an
academic
context.
That
is a big thing.
Very dangerous. These are words that will get you in big trouble. Beauty, truth, and elegance, grace, harmony. My goodness. And you know, seeking divinity, if you like. You know, these words are dangerous. And in a world where there is no meaning, as you're talking about, the flatlands world, you can't talk about those things because as soon as you start talking about them, you get away from rationality and the idea that everything can be explained by science. And I'm not so sure it can. You know, we do have strange mystical ideas, and it doesn't really matter what religion you share. But all philosophies find mysticism, and ultimately there's a mystical relationship between mankind and the universe. However you perceive God, it's the same relationship, you know. And I think that's almost entirely absent in the postmodern deconstruction of the world. By the way, I think we should talk about postmodernity just briefly. I know that's a horrifying subject, but we are postmodern ourselves. You know, we live in the postmodern world. This is the postmodern world, and we're part of it. We can't avoid postmodernity. There's no point in arguing against postmodernity. It's a done deal. We are postmodern. You know, in the 15th century, people didn't know then that they were living in the Renaissance. Right, the end of the medieval period was happening, and they were a bit confused and wondering what on earth was going on next. And they'd started digging into reviving neoclassical ideas, and those wonderful, lovely allegorical paintings had started emerging, and the idea that nature could explain something of the world was emerging again. And we're in that same place now. We've ended a period. What we're experiencing in postmodernity is uncertainty about what comes next. We don't know what this world is going to be called, and we won't for another few hundred years. So there's no point in arguing about postmodernity. We are postmodern ourselves. I think Odd Nerdrum is a good example of this. Odd Nerdrum is definitely a postmodern painter. Actually, that sounds controversial and kind of crazy, but the truth is that he uses all the forms that we would expect to find in a postmodern artist. He breaks down ideas. He reinvents an old-fashioned form. He uses shocking imagery in his work. It's really quite marvelous. He's entirely postmodern. He's a wonderful painter. I love his work, by the way.
Yes, he is. Wonderful.
Michael, I couldn't hear which artist that was that you referred to.
Odd Nerdrum. He's a Norwegian painter. He's in a bit of trouble at the moment because of some sort of a tax problem. The Norwegian government has condemned him, but he lives in Paris, so I think he's actually safe from being imprisoned, which is a pretty desperate plight. I think one of the worst parts of that whole thing is if he does surrender to the Norwegian government and get put in prison, that they say he won't be allowed to paint, which seems like cruel and unusual punishment to me. Yeah, I suppose because
torture.
It's his business and he makes his living at it. Yeah, really, torture. Can you imagine being banned from painting? It's just a hideous idea.
No. If folks are wondering, American artists did a number of, I believe Alison Malafronte at American Artists wrote an article on him. I know it's out there on the web. So, Michael, I'm probably going to put you on the spot here, but do you know how to spell his name so folks can Google him?
Odd Nerdrum, sure. O-D-D, Odd Nerdrum, N-E-R-D-R-U-M, Nerdrum.
Yeah.
Odd Nerdrum, very strange name, right?
It is, yeah. That's why I asked you to spell it. So folks can go out, Google him, and I know that American artist has had a number of things. He came to the Salmagundi Club, I believe, in New York, and did a talk there. So
yes,
I don't know if there's anything out there on.
I believe he's taught at the New York Academy. I don't know if he still does. I don't think he does. And he used to show his work at the Forum here in Los Angeles before that closed down. I think they still show his work in New York. So if you're on the East Coast, you could head over there and visit.
Right. Okay.
His work was a revelation to me years ago. I went to see it with a painter, old friend of mine called Christoph Cassidy, who works here in Los Angeles, and he invited me to go down to a show, which I think was in Long Beach. And seeing his paintings in a museum was a complete revelation to me because I didn't realize, first of all, that anyone could paint like that. Really, I thought it was all over and no one could paint properly anymore. And I was trying to reinvent it and trying to understand how to paint and just sort of feeling my way through it in my studio at home, trying to understand how those great masters did it. It was very difficult. Virgil Elliott's book was a tremendous help in understanding that, by the way. He's going to be speaking at the conference in October. So if you're interested in Virgil Elliott's work, you should come to that and hear what he has to say.
Yeah.
But Odd Nerdrum, I think, has been a revelation to many of us that are working in this representational art movement these days. He's an extraordinarily influential guy.
Absolutely. Barbara, I think we kind of went off on a little bit of a tangent. I think you had a follow-up.
Yes, definitely.
No, but it all is going to feed into this because, you know, you've mentioned Virgil Elliott, that he'll be speaking in the conference. And can you tell us about the conference itself? Who is involved and what is being presented at the conference?
Oh, my goodness, so much is on now at the conference. First of all, let me talk briefly about the genesis of it and how it happened at all. As I'd said earlier on, many of us were feeling really out alone painting these figurative and representational paintings, and we felt rather isolated. But here in California, there's a group of folks, and we all got to know each other mostly through the agency of Mike Adams and Tony Pro. Tony was spending a lot of time with his dear friends Alexi Steele and Jeremy Lipking, of course, who, again, all these folks are going to be at the conference, so you get to meet them all if you come. Tony Pro is well known on the internet and for his portraits and demonstrations, and I think you had him on the show a month ago, right? Over at the Masters convention
down
there. Yeah. Tony's such a wonderful colleague to have. He's just awesome. What a great guy. He's fabulous, and he paints so beautifully. And he's a real boon to the students here at the university. They get so much out of him. He's wonderful. What a great guy. And Mike Adams too. He's my colleague here for 7 years now, and we've become just the best of friends. And Mike Adams actually started the whole thing going with the conference. He'd spent a weekend with Richard Schmidt and Tony Pro and Alexei and Jeremy and a few other really well-known painters down at Alexei's studio, and came back up here, and we were walking through the university grounds here. We have beautiful campus, by the way, at Kalu. It's such a lovely place to work. And we were walking through the park in the middle of the campus, and we were chatting about his weekend with all these great painters, and he was saying, you know, this was just a wonderful time to spend with these other artists, and to feel that that excitement of being with great painters, and talk about art with them, and eat and drink and socialize and paint with them. And he just wanted to go on with that. And that got me thinking about this whole absence of discussion in the academic world. And so we started talking about how great it would be to bring painters together and introduce them to academic writers and academic thinkers in the same venue, so that the conversation takes on a sort of a foundational building point for this movement. We need the ideology. We need solidity, sort of a foundational platform to put everything on. If there's discussion and writing about what we're doing, then we become more meaningful. If we explain what we do, we become more significant. And so that's what really started the whole thing off. And since then, it's just grown and grown. We've found this wonderful community of artists, and everyone's so enthusiastic about participating in the conference. It's really a joy to hear people getting excited about what's happening. It really gives you the sense of being involved in something important and really wonderful. It's beautiful what's going on. I can't wait to be at the conference, you know, just from purely selfish reasons, just spending a few days literally at the beach and spending time with some of these guys who are just kind of heroes to me, actually. You look at the work that David Casson does, or Virgil Elliott. I'm just thrilled that Virgil is going to be there. Literally read that book, and he taught me how to paint. I never met him at that time, but I learned Ingres Eye painting from Virgil Elliott's book. Ruth Weisberg is there, who I did figure drawing with at USC, and I can't wait to see her and spend some time with her again. Vern Swanson's going to be there, who I've had for many years on my bookshelf. I had his books there. Graydon Parrish will be there. He's an amazing painter from the East Coast. He's the one who did that fabulous painting commemorating 9/11 with the figures, the Cycle of Terror and Tragedy. Just a magnificent painting. He'll be there. John Naver will be there from Ojai, and he's got those tapestries that he's created for the cathedral down in Los Angeles, and again, a very respected painter. Jed Pearl is coming from New York. He's the critic, of course, from New York. He's written numerous books about art and wrote for Vogue magazine and New York Times Book Review and Harper's and goodness knows how many magazines. So I'm excited to hear his keynote speech as well. He's got a new book coming out, which I can't remember the title of, but that's going to be coming out, and I think he's going to be selling signed copies of that at the conference too. So very exciting, some of the people who are coming. Sadie Valeri's coming from San Francisco. She's well known for her group, Women Painting Women, of course, but she's an amazing painter in her own right, and does this fabulous grisaille painting technique to work up the paintings. Really beautiful work. So, all coming together rather beautifully.
It sounds wonderful. Yeah. So, Michael, I'm going to kind of diverge from our outline that we had, because I wanted to go back to a question that we were talking about when you were talking about beauty. And
yes.
One of the things that, I keep wondering when you were talking if, if things had been taken too far, you know, we got all the reality programs and the different things that are out there, and shock value seems to be more important than beauty. And, you know, and like Barbara said, you know, I applaud everybody for sticking to their guns and painting representationally and all that. And I'm wondering if maybe folks are just getting tired of that shock value. They don't want to be shocked anymore. Like, you know, how absurd do I have to get before it gets to be boring or something? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know either. I don't know. I don't watch television, so I avoid most of that stuff. I think, you know what, my advice to all my students is to turn off your television set, because you're infecting yourself with this sort of cultural appreciation of nastiness and just wickedness. So there's very little. If you think about what you're seeing on TV, isn't most of it really about nastiness? And it's still about deconstruction and brokenness and damage and people with broken lives and distress and violence and blood. You know, how many murders do you see on TV every night? And when you turn it off, you don't see murders. You don't see it. You don't see the violence and brutality. It just doesn't happen that much. And so I recommend to the students that they turn that off and start paying attention to the beautiful things in life that are around them. You know, I was walking home last night, again, through this beautiful campus that we have here, and it was, you know, the gloaming, the twilight times when it's not quite dark, but it's not quite light either. It was like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the street lights were on, and everything looked like it was, I don't know, out of a Harry Potter movie or something. It was really pretty. And I was walking along and looking at the ground and looking at things around me, and I just stopped for a moment and thought, you know what? If I spend 5 minutes looking at this one single area, maybe a 10-foot square right here, I bet you I could find 5 or 6 really beautiful moments just in that 10-foot square. And it doesn't matter which 10-foot square it is. There's going to be 5 or 6 beautiful things happening in the dirt or on the lamppost or whatever it was, you know, that these small moments of beauty. And for us to think that the world is broken and decadent and nasty, just I don't think that's true. And I won't think it's true. And I will talk about beauty. And I think that we all should be able to talk about beauty and grace and elegance without feeling like we're doing something wrong. That's crazy. The world is beautiful.
That's a wonderful
Bravo. I completely agree with you. And, you know, there was a conference and I don't remember exactly when it was. I mentioned this on an earlier radio show, but the contemporary writer Dave Hickey, who I think won a MacArthur Award, and he's an art critic and has done a lot of writing on art. And at the end of a conference, they went around and they asked, you know, what does anyone have a last comment? Does anyone have a last question? And his question was, well, what about beauty? What about beauty? And he said that the room went dead. He wrote an entire essay about it. And it was like he had just, you know, said a swear word, just told a dirty story in front of this whole group because, you know, it was, and the people had turned away. And he was absolutely shocked, and he knew he was onto something by that reaction of, well, what about beauty? And and when you say turn off the TV, you know, I'm a mother. I've raised 3 children and still have 1 at home. And I've done a lot of research on how the brain actually reacts to screen time. And one of the teachers who won the Teacher of the Year Award in New York City for teaching computer science, his big recommendation to the schools was to limit time that children had on the computer, learning on the computer, because they were growing up without the ability to have patience and to be in the natural world with patience and to develop their ability to see. And his example of that was he saw a bunch of children giving a presentation on the ecology of a pond. And they would click one button and the little deer would pop out and another one and the frog would jump off the lily pad into the pond. And they had all their facts together, but then he asked them if any of them had actually been to a pond, and none of them had. And
right.
He talked about
They've
how
never seen
you know,
a cow.
We have this, that's right, we have this instant gratification on a computer or a computer screen, whereas the ability to develop patience to sit quietly so that the wildlife will come out, you know, is something that is being overlooked now, so that kids get bored and they don't develop that other ability to be in the world, which is, in my opinion, the ability you need to have as an artist, patience to see beauty and to be creative and use your imagination and not have the instant gratification.
That is true.
I think there's very little instant gratification in good painting, don't you? When you look at a really great painting, you look at a Rubens or some fabulous piece of work, you don't switch it off for years. You come back to that painting and look at it again and again, and you find new things in it all the time. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's one of the great things, the big differences between painting and other forms of visual expression.
Which is something Sherry McGraw said last week. If you look at a good painting, it gets better and better and better the longer you look at it. And just the same is true with a bad painting. It just gets worse and worse. But that time and that ability to go deep into something, to look at the world, to look at painting, even to read, apparently, there's a lot of... I taught at the university for a number of years, too, Michael, and noticed a difference in how I would have to present in lectures in order to keep the attention of the students as they came along. The shorter attention spans.
Yes, yes. Well, and going back to viewing a painting, it takes a long time to learn to paint that way. That takes a lot of patience. It doesn't just happen quickly.
Yeah, it sure does. You know, you can see the students getting it and gradually building their skill set and creating really good paintings. It's really quite wonderful to see. You know, here at the university, we've got a wonderful faculty that guides our students through that, and with great patience, I might add. You know, I think teaching painting isn't the easiest thing in the world, because we do want to have results. And sometimes it takes quite a long time to earn the skills, that you need in order to do it. I remember learning how to use a fan brush, and it took me 2 or 3 days to be able to use a fan brush to figure out blending and really get it right, you know. I remember just doing it over and over again to get it so I really got blending. You know, some people pick this up right away, and it's easy to them. Other people find it very tricky. But these skills aren't necessarily easy to come by. So there's a balance to be struck when you're teaching painting, to see when someone makes a breakthrough and gets something, and they become fearless about putting paint on the canvas. And that's quite wonderful to see. I love teaching painting.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness, what a joy it is. Because most of our students here, we run a liberal arts program, you see. So we get all kinds of students. Some of our students are very, very good and very knowledgeable about art and painting, and others have had no classes at all, ever, in their life, in our lower division classes. And so my favorite classes, actually, are my lower division classes, where I find students who had no idea of what real painting was about, and they switch on like a light bulb. It's just so wonderful to see that happening with them. Gosh, what a joy.
That would be rewarding.
You bet. Tony has the same experiences, I'm sure. Tony Pro. Mike Adams teaches painting here as well now. You know, I'm sure all of us have very similar experience with it.
Yeah. Well, it's such an intense experience to see someone come alive and get it and realize that the more they become aware and it's not just techniques, but seeing that then something they create can actually have a life of its own on that canvas.
And then what another joy is when you see these guys after they've been training with us for a few years and they've become excellent painters and they start showing their work out in the world and with great quality. We've been experiencing invitations coming in to do faculty and student shows recently around Ventura County here where we live. And that's been quite exciting because we get to show our students' work alongside our work. So that's fascinating to see how we influence our students. I really like that. I enjoy that very much. That's a kick. And then seeing them become themselves and how they develop their own ideas later on in life. Christopher Marshall was one of my students long ago now, must be 5 or 6 years ago, and he went off to the New York Academy and did his master's degree there and worked with Odd Nerdrum and developed his own unique style. He doesn't paint anything like me now. When he started, he was painting very similarly. And I love that, and seeing the students develop themselves and become have their own identity in their work. I think that's wonderful. What a treat to see that. Luis Pena and Nikki Valentine are both going to be showing their work at TRAC. They won a scholarship, which included being able to show a painting in the hotel. So I'm looking forward to seeing how well that goes over.
Yes. Michael, tell me, I don't know if we talked about, I'm sorry, Linda. I don't know if we've talked about the dates for the conference. When is the conference?
Well, it's from the 14th to the 17th of October in Ventura, California. You can register for it and see a lot of information about it on our website, which is http://TRAC2012.org. So TRAC2012.org. So it's http://TRAC2012.org. And there's a ton of information on there, including registration and all that good stuff, information about the hotel. It's a wonderful hotel, by the way. It's right on the beach. If I didn't mention that before, I can't wait to be in the bar on the beach.
That sounds great, yeah. And registration starts at what time on the 14th, Michael?
Oh, boy, you've got me there. I believe it's 3 or 4 o'clock. I don't remember, actually.
Okay.
I apologize. But that's on the Sunday, the 14th, is when it starts up. So the Sunday is the travel day, and then in the evening we have a welcoming reception, which I think will be really a great time. We get to, as I said, spend time by the beach at the hotel and meet each other there, and the president of CLU will be there. To greet everybody, which is quite exciting. Jed Pearl, I believe, will be there, and a few others of the keynote faculty will be there.
Yeah.
John Mather will be there for sure.
Sorry, Michael. And following along, I interrupted you before, so I apologize for that. I wanted to take us back to the conversation that you and I had offline when we first talked, and we had mentioned we were talking about representational art and how they can't seem to get past the front door to be shown in major museums. And do you think that will change? I'm getting towards the comment that you made to me about, well, if the major museums aren't going to show us, then maybe we need to create our own museums.
Right.
So
We're at zero, aren't we? We're starting off, as you said, on the flatlands. I think we need to stake our claim in the plains of postmodernity, if you like. We need to be the homesteaders. If postmodernity is a flat land, and we're looking over this landscape of grayness, then let's build our own things. We do our own things. But having said that, we do have islands within these gray plains where there are these places of light and brightness. I'm thinking of the Carnegie Museum, for example, and over in Malibu we have the Weissman Museum at Pepperdine, where Michael Zakin does a wonderful job of showing a lot of representational art. There are islands of representational art around, and they're getting stronger. There was recently a very interesting show up in Lancaster, for example, in California. And then over in New York, there's a few galleries there. The Forum, of course, is a beacon of representational work. And then the New York Academy and the Artists League, Students League in New York. So it's not like we're actually completely alone. And we are emerging out of that darkness of the 20th century and into the light again, thank goodness. So I think there's a great deal of hope. And I think that it's important for representational artists of all kinds to get together and show work, you know, just show that we are out there and we're not alone. We really aren't alone. Things like Facebook and organizations like that are extremely helpful in gathering together groups of artists and making shows happen. Shows don't have to be in an art gallery. It doesn't have to be in a gallery. You know, you can make your own space somehow. And I would urge people to make little groups and make this happen. There's no reason that we can't do it. We just have to take the bull by the horns and make it happen for ourselves. You know, why would we actually want critical appreciation from postmodernist philosophers? You know, you're asking the leopard to change its spots. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Postmodern philosophers.
Well, they wouldn't
aren't going
even
to
have
become,
the vocabulary
no.
to
and
critique the work.
The vocabulary would be completely different. Yeah.
Intention of the work is completely different.
Yes. So we need to build our own critical language. And that, again, that's why we're doing the conferences. We need to have critical appreciation of what we're doing from voices who understand what we're doing. And that's what we're all about. We want to have discussion, and there's no reason why we shouldn't do that. That's why we built the conference. It really is. That's it. And hopefully this will give us as a movement, will give us more confidence that we can go ahead with foundations that are real, that we do have a community of people who are smart and talking about this in critical terms and making sense of it all. I'm interested in how ideas affect this, because one of the reasons that you don't see representational art in museums, I suspect, is because the great museums, the big ones, have to make money. They've got to sell tickets. And the art has to be dramatic and exciting and challenging in some way. And I think that's something we need to address. We need to put together bodies of work that are really startling in some way and magnificent. And I think that's important, too.
Michael, do you think this is truly a renaissance, a revolution, maybe the start of a new movement toward beginning to appreciate representational art again?
Yeah, I do. You know, I don't know that it's going to take over the entire art world. I doubt that very much. I mean, I personally really rather like a lot of installation art. I used to make installation art myself, and I appreciate some of it. I think there's an awful lot of really bad art out there, but it's still art. And it'll still be made for a long time, you know. But the important thing for me is that we stake our claim, that we have, in this period now, where the planes are flat and gray, we have the right to do what we want to do and be taken seriously doing it. And I think that's the issue, really. I don't want to see postmodern art being destroyed or eradicated. I don't think that's a good idea either. There's a lot of really good ideas in what's been happening in the last 100 years. There's a lot of rubbish too, but there are some really great things. You know, there's some wonderful art out there. I'm thinking of Bill Viola's video work and installations. They're just beautiful, and a number of other artists. They make beautiful things. So I think we are a movement. But I wouldn't like to see us try to claim that we're the only way that art can be made. I don't think that's mm-hmm. not right. That makes a false claim.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. I would like to have other forms or genres of art that are out there to draw from, too.
Yeah, indeed. You know, there's a great deal of inspiration to be had there. I think it's curious, isn't it, that some of the representational artists that are out there don't really get recognized as representational artists, which is odd. I'm thinking of Jeff Koons, for example, and he made the enormous balloon dog and things like that, the Michael Jackson okay. stuff. He's a representational artist, but he's very unpopular among representational artists.
That is true.
I think there's an irony to that. And he gets into all the big museums. What is it? Is it resentment that he's successful, or is it this superficiality of his work, which is deliberate? You know, I think that's quite intriguing.
Yeah, it is.
You know. And what about Kincaid? He's a perennial obsession of mine. I regularly think about Thomas Kincaid's work and how he's completely despised by so many artists. You talk about Kincaid and Koons, it's the same sort of level of loathing for many artists. I think that's ironic, too. He's a wildly successful representational artist. Yeah.
I wonder if your word superficiality is maybe one of the keys there when you're working so hard to see beneath the surface and to come up with good design and good patterns of light and dark and have this painting have a strong abstract structure and then say something truthful about what it is you're painting. But what about those two artists that you mentioned, Kincaid and Koons? What made them so popular? What quality in their work appealed to so many people?
Yeah, indeed. And I don't know, with Kincaid, he obviously is very into this sort of fantastic world, and he wants to make the world better, doesn't he? In Kincaid's world,
yeah.
All the lights are always on. It's always just been snowing, but it's somehow nice and warm inside the cottage,
yeah.
Right?
It is beautiful, right?
this
yeah.
Perfect, idealized world, and it's all candy-colored.
Yeah.
It's
well, and there's some
delightful,
nostalgia
you know.
For that.
Yeah, it's
and
very
it, you know, maybe
nostalgic.
That in itself is a... There's a backlash against all the deconstruction, violence, murders,
yeah,
et cetera,
yeah.
that you do see on the TV
sure.
To retreat.
Yeah.
Who knows? I haven't thought about it like that before.
Yeah. The sort of a brightness
and freshness. You know, if representational art is a renaissance or a revolution, there's a lot of artists that are just working every day in their studios. And, you know, what can all of us do to help and to get involved?
I think pushing the envelope is really important. You know, there are so many really great painters out there who can do fabulous head studies and fabulous figure studies and wonderful still lifes. How do we push the envelope further? What does it mean to go beyond that? And, you know, look at the 19th century. Look at those Pre-Raphaelite painters who, by the way, there's an amazing show in London of Pre-Raphaelite art, which I can't wait to go see. I'm going to go visit it. And get into some of that sort of grand-scale work, which deals with what's going on for us now. And, again, I don't
mm-hmm.
want to get nostalgic. I want to paint for now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. How do you paint mm-hmm. paintings that are about the 21st century? How do you choose subjects which represent us? I see so many paintings of beautiful models with turbans. To me, that's talking about the 19th century, and I totally appreciate them. I think they're wonderful. I love 19th century art, but I'm really interested in how we use the techniques of the 19th century and before that to make work that's about what we're experiencing right now and what's happening in the world now. I think David Casson does that in his paintings. He's using classical technique, grisaille painting technique. To make paintings that are very resonant with what's in the 21st century. I hope my own work does that. My show at the moment has 30 paintings in it, which I hope help to bring us into a new landscape of painting, a new world of painting.
Well, and then pushing the envelope, too, depending on what you're drawn to paint. A lot of us paint, you know, number of things, figurative landscapes, still life. But with the landscape, there seems to be a particular urgency as, you know, some of the most pristine places are lost.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you want to experience those and also share that experience with people viewing your art and have
yeah.
them...
Yeah.
Have a taste of it and even want to get out there themselves and fall in love with it.
Right, and isn't it amazing when you can look at a really beautiful landscape and just see, like, the delicacy of one leaf with water on it, or, you know, the one branch touching the water in the pool, just such delicate little moments that you can capture in a really elegant painting that will just mm-hmm. grab your heart, you know. Totally fundamental and important, and I'll never decry those paintings. I love them. Mike Adams' Still Lives do that. You know, you've got these very simple paintings of household fruits and vegetables and stuff that you'd find anywhere, but he catches the light on them in such a way that they're just gorgeous. They're just beautiful moments. And you can't beat it. You just can't get away from these moments of great beauty that are going to be captured by paintings and by really good artists.
Well, there's a poem that I have hanging in my studio by Jane Hirschfeld called Lake and Maple, where in this poem it really, in some of the most beautiful words ever, is able to express in words why I paint. And it is those amazing moments where you are, you transcend yourself and you do become, sounds very mystical, but you do become one with what's out there. There's a much bigger connection.
Uh-huh.
And she describes this moment so beautifully. Yeah, you might look it up. Well, I'll send it to you. It's called Lake and Maple by Jane uh-huh. Hirschfeld.
I don't think there's anything wrong with seeking a bit of the mystical in our lives. You know, the world is a beautiful place, as we said earlier on, and that mystical relationship to nature is, I think, absolutely essential. And that's part of what I'm really hungry for in the world of art. I love art that catches my heart like that. I really do. And I think it resonates very, very strongly with a lot of other people, too.
You don't get those moments or realize even the value of your life until perhaps you have the privilege to be with someone at the end of their life, you know, and you realize just the deep appreciation for that life force and what it can bring. And, you know, if art can bring us to that place without having to have that experience of losing a loved one or, you know, ourselves yeah. having a terminal illness, you know, it's yeah. a lot more pleasant to get
right,
there. But
indeed.
That deep appreciation of being yeah. alive.
Yeah. Well, and the drama of it, too. You know, I look at Alexei Steele's work. We've got a show of Alexei's amazing drawings coming up at the university here. And I can't wait to get my gallery here filled up with those drawings because he captures these moments, but they're super big and super dramatic as well. It's
yes.
a delicate thing to do is to balance that, you know, but he draws them so beautifully and these figures are so wonderful and sort of sensual and gorgeous. I'm really excited about stuff like that. Because I think that's what we need. We need to capture beauty, but do it in a dramatic and spectacular way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael, we've been talking for about an hour, and I do want to get to your show. And so tell us a little bit about your current show that's at the Carnegie.
Yes, my pleasure to do so. It's at the Carnegie Museum, as you said, which is in Oxnard, California. It's pretty easy to find. They're on the web. You can search them out. The website is www.carnegieam.org. So CARNEGIEAM.org, Carnegie Art Museum. And the show is in there. It's called Emblemata. And there are about 30 of my paintings in there. They're allegorical paintings, and they're fully loaded with symbolism and emblematic ideas. They're mystical and mythic, and I think you'll like them. They're quite strange to some people. They're deliberately designed to let you figure out what's going on. So, for example, there's a painting of a man sitting in a very high chair that's made out of sticks. And he's holding a golden ball, and he has a stick with a silver moon on it. And the chair he's sitting on is covered with morning glory creepers that are emerging from a woman's mouth. and she's sitting on the ground below and pointing up towards him, gesturing up towards him, and it's a cyclical painting. And I want people to look at paintings like that and figure them out and get deep into their own interpretation of what's happening. See, to me, that painting is all about nature and materialism. The guy in the chair is materialism. And the woman sitting on the ground with the vines coming out is all about nature. I want people to be looking at nature and appreciating nature and the allegories that are in the paintings, right?
Right. Yeah. When you had talked about the chair that made out of sticks and things like that, that has everything to do with the person's life not being materialistic on this side, and then him holding the globe that you're talking about is that his rewards come later in life.
Yeah, you see, I hadn't thought of it like that. You see how this works?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, no, exactly. When you were talking about it, I was like, oh wow. And the only reason why I said that, Michael, you're gonna get chills, is because I had a dream a long time ago, well, about a year ago, that one of my aunts who had passed, someone was preparing her a throne on the other side, and it was made of wood. So I did a lot of dream interpretation at that point, and that's what that meant. So that's the only reason why I probably really went to that. So it's kind of strange that you decided to talk about that particular painting, but it's really kind of interesting. And then, again, I also read your current Facebook page about the dream that you had. And
oh, yeah, wasn't that strange, huh?
Yeah. So that was kind of interesting. But, yeah, so go ahead and tell us more about your show, if there's anything you want to say.
Wow. Well, it's been a long process. There's paintings in there from about 10 years now, 10 years of painting. You can see the development of the style, my style, and the way it's going. And I've really been trying to find myself in painting, trying to understand what makes my painting mine. And I've started doing things more, more brazenly. I don't care so much anymore about other people's opinions about what I do. I just want to do it. I just want to make paintings and make work as good as I can. And I want it to be dramatic, so I paint very big. These are not small paintings. There's very few of the pieces that are under 6 feet, I guess, in one direction or the other. The majority of them are about 6 feet by 8 feet, something like that. I like painting emblems, as I said before, that have allegorical meaning. And in fact, a lot of the ideas that are expressed in the paintings are similar to books that used to be published in the 15th through 17th centuries. And these books would have pictures and then a rather curious epigram published beside them. And actually, at the show, you'll find epigrams, little quotes, beside each one of the paintings. And I want people to look at the paintings and read the text and be able to dig deeper into the painting by putting those things together. So that you're thinking. I want people to be in a thoughtful state. And hopefully I want people to get these images into their consciousness so that they spark dreams or sort of mystical ideas in their heads and switch on their imagination a bit.
I was fascinated when I went and looked up and learned more about Emblemata, those books that were published, and that they were, in wide circulation for centuries.
Oh,
and
yeah, very popular, yeah, yeah.
Very
amazing.
Popular, very influential just to everyone, and I wondered, what your process, what your journey was from knowing about those and then creating these spectacular paintings. Mm.
Wow. Well, they kind of went together. I discovered the books through. I'm trying to think back when the first one was that I got. I think probably through looking at old playing cards. Actually, I became very interested in playing cards from the 15th century, particularly a deck of cards called the Visconti Sforza cards. These cards were really beautiful, and they had lots of gold decoration and some very interesting pictures on them, which didn't make a great deal of sense. And so I started looking at these because they're being made right at the same time as the Renaissance is coming into being. And yeah. I found out that the cards were actually expressing a lot of the ideas that were around at the time of the Renaissance, the late medieval period, blending into the Renaissance particularly. And so I started writing and reading and studying and getting really deep into the symbolism of those cards, and then realizing that actually I could merge my intellectual life with my studio life, and started painting imagery that I found resonated with those same cards. Do you see what I mean?
That some of the imagery and symbolism from back then, do you think that we still resonate?
Oh, yeah.
Similar
imagery
kidding? Now?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
this is stuff that it goes
I'd love
back
to hear about that.
Oh, sure. You know, my PhD was all about prehistoric British sacred art and architecture. So I spent a lot of time visiting Neolithic chambered cairns and mounds and lots of stone circles and megalithic things, and had an amazing time crawling through little tiny passageways into these chambers that are hidden in the ground and exploring those sacred spaces. And it was an amazing experience to get really deep into the archaeology of that. And in the course of doing that work, I found out that archaeology is really colored very deeply by the 17th century, which is a strange thing, because our understanding of prehistory is really shaped by the people who started digging up those things in the first place and what they thought it was all about. And so that got me into reading people like Stukeley and Aubrey, who were very early archaeologists, and writing about what they were discovering. And thank goodness they wrote about it, because right when they were writing about it, people were destroying those sites because they didn't matter. They were just piles of rocks, right? They were ruins. No one cared. And so they were demolishing them and turning them into walls and buildings and things. And can you believe they were knocking down the stones of Stonehenge and breaking them up to make farm walls? Amazing.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, incredible now, right? But back then it was totally okay. So thank goodness they wrote about it and described these sites. And that led me to reading more of their writings and finding out that, well, Stukeley was a druid. And I thought, what? What? What are you talking about? He's a druid. And that got me into, yeah, really. And did you know Winston Churchill was a druid?
Yeah,
no,
I didn't
know that. I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing, right? Quite extraordinary. The traditions have been carried on and revived since about the 16th century, when Freemasonry starts growing up in England, and all these folks were part of the Royal Society in the beginning of science and early research into alchemy and how things were made, and it all ties into natural philosophy and the way that the universe has indications of order within it. And that's really, really important, because if the universe has order, then there's structure to it, and that means there's creation to it in some way. And I won't dare to even get into what that means, because I don't understand it at all. But it sure is an ordered place. There is harmony within the universe, and that gives me great hope for beauty and the indestructible nature of beauty. And despite the 20th century, beauty shall live forever.
Michael, I was just curious, as well, if Amelia Earhart made it into Emblemata and all the recent press about her finding her plane.
Yeah, that's a bit
plane.
Odd.
Has that influenced you?
Well, no, it hadn't, but Amelia got in there because she's so related to the element of air for me. You know, she flies off into the air to circumnavigate the globe, right? So in alchemical terms, this is a very beautiful allegory that this earthly creature gets into the air and becomes the spirit of air to go around the world and around the earth itself. And like Icarus, she flies too high and probably falls into the water. And so this is a perfect alchemical allegory, which I just thought was too good to be true, beautiful. And I think she was an amazing woman, Amelia Earhart. What courage, huh, to try that.
Oh, yeah.
But I didn't know that they had found her plane at the time that I was doing those paintings.
When you were kind enough to share the photos of the installation of your show and your work beforehand on the Facebook page. Were the pillars and all the architecture already part of the Carnegie Museum, or is
that
part of the
museum? Definitely.
That's
yeah,
the
they're all part of the museum. The museum is really a beautiful little building. It's you know, this neoclassical temple. It's a wonderful place.
Mm-hmm.
I just love it. When you go inside the front door now, you walk into this opening hallway, and it's I don't know. For some reason, it makes me think I'm looking at this wonderful box of chocolates, because there's all this decorative pillar work going on, and then these colorful paintings that you catch glimpses of between the pillars, and they're so tempting. It's like being in a candy store. You just want to go and enjoy the art, and I really like it for that. It's like the museum is the perfect frame for my paintings. I really enjoy it.
Oh, that's great. I wish I could see it.
Well, you must come to Oxnard, come to the conference. We're doing some side trips as part of the conference, in fact. We'll take a busload of people over to the Carnegie, which is a great treat for me. I'm really looking forward to that. And we'll bring a bus over here to the university as well, where we'll visit Alexei Steele's show of magnificent drawings up in the Kwan Fong Gallery at CLU.
Oh, that'd be
so
wonderful
two big treats.
To see your show.
Well, you must register. Come to the conference.
Especially with you there. How long is the show going to run?
Emblemata is on from September 9th to November the 18th, and there's going to be a couple of talks. I'm going to be doing an artist's talk on November the 8th about madness and pilgrimage, and I'll be talking about the traveler, the fool in late medieval Milan particularly. And then on November the 15th, I'm going to do another talk, which I've titled The Thin Man. And that's basically a paper I've written about the magician and the nature of this magician in the 15th century, the Visconti Sforza magician, he's known as, talking about who he is and what he actually means. And really, shall I give you a secret? He's a writer.
Yeah.
It's the secret of this guy, and I'll explain why he's a writer.
Yeah,
do come.
Would we be able to get copies of your presentations, Michael?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I'll arrange for someone to record them. I'll post them on the internet.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure to do that. Yeah. Yeah, I can do that. I'll put them on the website. I'll put a link on Facebook when that time comes up. And by the way, I'd like to encourage anyone listening to find me on Facebook and also find the university page there and to find Track, of course. We have our own Track page on Facebook. It's easy to find. It's facebook.com/track2012.org. Track2012, I beg your pardon. So facebook.com/TRAC2012. That's easy to find. And I'm on there. I'm easy to find on Facebook. And CLU Art is the art department website.
Okay, well, we're at the point of the show where we're down to our last questions. So I'm going to go to Barbara first for her last question.
I have so many. I don't have a last question because, like the conversation
you
want another hour, Linda. But I was just, you know, just to follow up when you said yes, that these images are quite the same, that they, there's something that's universal about them that had meaning to people several hundred years ago and meaning to us now. I wondered if there were just a few symbols or images that you'd be willing to share with us that you found in common.
Wow. Well, the Hanged Man.
Okay.
I think that one's a good one. There's in one of my paintings, the Hanged Man is suspended.
You did
from
a painting of the Hanged Man.
I sure did, yeah. It's a very big painting. It's about 10 feet high and 5 feet
wide.
Yeah,
I was looking at
really
it.
Quite a big one. I think he's a very old image, and he's quite misunderstood. People think he's Odin and things like that, but he's not. What's going on with him, he's suspended from the heavens, and he's reaching down to the ground and trying to touch the ground in my painting. And he's reaching towards a stone which has carvings in it, which date from about 4000 BC. It's an actual place up in Lincolnshire where I was born. And it's really all about modern man trying to reach back to his roots. And where do we come from? And what does it mean to look at our own roots? Who are we? And have we betrayed ourselves? You know, have we betrayed our ancestors by not paying attention to where we come from? And the hangman starts out in the 15th century as a symbol of betrayal in Milan. In Milan, they would paint traitors upside down and hanged by one foot. They would actually kill people occasionally who were caught as traitors and suspend them upside down in order to kill them by one leg. And this still happens now. In fact, in Mexico, in the drug wars down there, they hang up traitors upside down from freeway bridges occasionally. It's quite ugly and unpleasant. Mm. But it's this very, it shows that it's a very old symbol and still in use now. This emblem still has resonance even now. The reference to Odin, by the way, comes from traitors being hung up as gifts to the sky god Odin, and they would suspend their victims up in the trees for the wind to take. Mm. So deep roots there.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you.
Blanche, your last question or statement?
I just wanted to ask about your students. What are their aspirations after getting their degrees? Are they wanting to become exhibiting artists or work in the animation field?
Obviously, it varies from student to student. I think one of the important things that we have to offer at CLU is that we do have students who come out with a degree, so they end up with a bachelor's degree, which has value in the marketplace. As far as their individual desires, you know, they might want to get into animation or filmmaking. We're very well placed for that. These days, there are so many careers in art. The idea of the starving artist is totally redundant, in my view. I kind of resent Vincent van Gogh for perpetrating the myth of the starving artist, because at the same time that he was busy deliberately being hungry down in the south of France, there were numerous very, very successful artists in the 19th century.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at Bouguereau. He was a rock star of the 19th century, and numerous others. The Pre-Raphaelites weren't exactly short on a penny or two, were they? You know, they did very, very well. So this myth of the starving artist that's been perpetrated upon us in the 20th century, I think, is totally unrealistic, and I think it's part of that deliberate campaign to devalue and decry representational art. You can see that in the 20th century, where representational art is really deliberately talked badly of, you know, and denigrated in the world. So I kind of resent Vincent van Gogh for that, and I'm a bit mad about the whole thing. You know, there's no need to view art as being unique in difficulty when you graduate from school. If I want to start a shoe business, I would expect that the first 10 years are going to be pretty tough, wouldn't you? It doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
You start your own business in any field.
Yeah,
and
it's
I would
not
expect
why with
my... Right, so why would it be any different for art? You know, it's going to take 10 years to get a business going. If you want to be a freelancer and do your own thing, it's going to take a while. And you're going to have periods when it's difficult. On the other hand, you're going to have periods when it's really good. And you're going to be deeply, deeply satisfied because you're following your heart. You're making the thing which you love to make. And this is America, darn it. You know, this is still the land of opportunity, and where you can do whatever you want to do and make it work, and no one's going to tell you you can't. And I love that about America. I think it's just the best place in the world. You can do anything here and make yourself, reinvent yourself, and make a success of yourself. And I don't think it's any different for artists at all. Having said that, if you want to have a career in art where you have a salary, then, boy, isn't now the most visual culture that the world has ever seen? You know, there's so many careers in art that you can have right now if you want to get a salary. You're going to have the dissatisfaction of working for someone other than yourself, but you're definitely going to have a career in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and all those commercial art people who are working in the film business and making animated movies, and actually every single movie you see now has the hand of an artist in it, because so much of it is about digital background work that has to look so realistic that it's convincing, right? Every single movie you see, that it's been touched. And so there's amazing career opportunities there. And guess what those guys are all doing? All those Disney animators, they go take life drawing classes. They take life painting classes. They study. You know, our models work for them.
Yeah, that's the same stuff. They need that.
And so to me, it's kind of crazy that art schools aren't playing into that. And I would hope that parents listening to the show are aware of that, that their students, when they go to art school, look for a school which teaches the students how to do real art, the techniques of reality, and the techniques that are offered in ateliers, and get training in that. I think Kowloon has an edge there because we do offer a bachelor's degree, and that's a recognized qualification for our students, that they get a very good holistic course here. They're not going to study just art. They're going to get a liberal arts program here. I think that's wonderful because you get a touch of everything in that. It gives you a very broad life.
Yeah, that's really valuable.
Lightens my heart to hear you say that. I wish I'd come across somebody like you when I was a young art student.
Well, hopefully we can fix that for, you know, new generations of artists, huh? You know, we spoke briefly about this earlier on, how disappointed many of us were when we went to art school in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and mm-hmm. how no one could offer the training that we really wanted, because we wanted to learn how to paint like the old masters, and no one knew. I remember seeing a demonstration which purported to be a demo of how Rembrandt used reflected light, and it was just a travesty. The artist clearly had no clue how to paint, and he must have been cajoled into doing this somehow, I don't know. No one knew, and thank God for people like Virgil Elliott and Richard Schmidt and some of the others who kept the traditions going in this dark period when things were so bad for representational art. And thank God that we're coming out of it again now, into this dawn, if you like, of representational art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exciting to think about.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. It really is a good time to be a representational artist. There's a lot of exciting stuff going on. But with that comes some responsibility, too. We have to produce work that's meaningful for the 21st century. We can't dwell on the 19th century and recreate the 19th century. We need to be mm-hmm. present. Otherwise, we're not going to capture the imaginations of 21st century people.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Michael, at this point, you probably feel like you've been talking the whole time, which you have, and that's the point of the show. So, yeah, thank you for indulging me. But no, I mean, yeah, you know, I actually have found it very, very interesting and wonderful to talk with you. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to also have kind of your last comments here, and also tell us, you know, you talked a little bit about what you're going to be doing with the current show that you have, but tell us what else might be coming up that you're thinking about doing as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know, I want to keep Emblem Arta going. I want to get the show traveling and get into other museums and let it see the world a bit. I don't want these paintings just to sit around at home. That's not what they're for. They're deliberately designed for museums, and I want to see this show travel, so hopefully I can find more institutions that will be willing to show them and keep it going around. I want to keep working on track and keep the conference going in some form. We're not sure yet about if we'll do it next year or do it the year after and make it a biannual event. We really don't know yet, and so we'll be keeping everyone posted with that. I plan to keep writing and keep talking and keep promoting representational art as much as I possibly can.
Great. And I was going to ask you, is this TRAC's first year?
This is, yeah. This is a brand new conference. As far as I know, there hasn't been a conference like this probably since, 1910 or something. It's been a very, very long time since people have really gotten together to discuss the issues of representational art. So I'm very excited about that. I think we're putting our footprints on the ground with this, and I think that's a very good thing. I really do see it as a foundation.
I think it's thrilling what you're doing. It's absolutely thrilling and inspiring.
It is.
Well, thank you for that. I hope so. I do hope so. I think it's worth doing. I really do think this is a necessary thing for us. We need this.
Yeah, I agree. And I know that you have been absolutely crazily busy between your show and pulling track together. And also, I think Cal Lutheran just started their, are they on semesters?
Yeah.
So you have a new class.
Yeah, we have a fall semester and a spring semester. We've just started the fall semester a couple of weeks ago. So the whole campus is crazy busy. Cal Lu is doing very well. You know, we've got a lot of new students. It's amazing that in a time where all you hear is about institutions that are doing badly, we've grown every year for the last 5 years, I think. It's really great to be at a university like this. We are doing very, very well.
Okay.
It's exciting.
And I'm assuming that growth in the art department has happened as well?
Yeah, we're seeing growth. We're getting more majors coming in. I think that's mostly to do with our faculty. We have wonderful faculty here. Our buildings are not particularly fabulous, but the university is very keen to fix that. And I'm sure that we'll see some good news in the next couple of years about that. We'll get much better facilities than we have. But the faculty we have here are all really, really good people. You know, we have wonderful watercolorists, Teresa Spihar-Fahy and Tony Pro and Mike Adams and Bela Bacci, the sculptor, is here. He's an amazing stone carver. You wouldn't believe how he carves stone to make it look like it's just as thin as a tissue paper. You know, he's just amazing.
Wow.
And all sorts of good stuff being made and wonderful quality work being done here. And our students seem to appreciate that. I think they know that they're in a place where really wonderful things are happening. They see us as a center.
Good.
That sounds like a fun place for the students to be.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't beat it. I mean, it's just such a wonderful campus. It's beautiful. And studying art amongst these folks. And I'm kind of jealous of my colleagues, to be honest with you. They're so good at it.
You have all the headaches that come with being the chair of the department, right?
So. Oh, it's you know what? It's totally worth it. It's completely
worth it.
I love doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Michael, it's come to the point in the show where we like to thank you very much for sharing your time with us. Like, I know you're very, very busy at this point, and we definitely appreciate you taking time to talk with us and making our world richer. I know that I'm going to become a better painter just from knowing you and hearing what you had to say today on the show. It was great. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you all, and I hope you have a wonderful time in Virginia, Blanche, and Barbara in Albuquerque. It's wonderful to be talking to you across the continent. It's a real treat. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Michael.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll keep in touch, naturally, if anything, at least through Facebook, but please do drop us a line every once in a while. Let us know what you're up to, and we would very much like to stay in touch. And to all our listeners out there who were listening, we thank you so much for tuning in, and our next show will be on October 18th. And again, we're going to be talking about keeping it fresh, inspiration from exploration and learning. And there'll be more information on that at the AMMO site and also in the newsletter that'll be coming out in a little while. So thanks, everybody, for being here. And, Michael, thank you again, and have a great day and evening.
Thank you, and I'll say goodbye.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.